It's the Zombie Free Will edition of Radio Free Wink Thinker. This week, Bibles and Chilliwack, Atheist Marriage, Vaccine Recall, Stats Fail, Spooky Music, Zombie Planets, and a chat about free will and Sam Harris. Let's begin episode 187.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. Place where reason and reality cross swords for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we've traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is Ethan, your freethinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. Ethan, have you heard? Apparently the bounty has been sunk yet again.
Yet again?
Yes. I was kind of surprised. I had heard in the news that the bounty had sunk. And I'm going, well, wasn't the bounty that, you know, one that was like 1700s or whatever, and they had castaways and Captain Bligh and all that? And I'm going, is that still around? And who the hell would take it out and sink it, right? Because it's like apparently Canada has the HMS Bounty. It's a flagship, you know, with the, what are the things that go in the wind? Sails, that's what I'm looking for.
Yes.
You have to realize I'm pantomiming sails here, so Ethan's getting the full show. But no, so apparently, you know, there's a big storm, and one of the people went out in the HMS Bounty, and they got caught up in the storm, and it sunk. And I'm going, like I say, isn't it? But apparently it was a remake or remodel that they had built in the 60s, so it wasn't like the original, because I was going, that would be a huge thing if you sunk like a 200-year-old, 300-year-old ship, but it was only like 40 or 50 years old. But then again, who takes a sailing ship out in what is quote-unquote the perfect storm? And I might point out, this is the second perfect storm we've had in a while, so I think there's a bit of hyperbole. This is the more perfect storm. In the 90s, they had, or is it the 80s, they had The Perfect Storm, which was made into what I thought was really a bad docudrama. It was a good drama, but documentary-wise, it was like half of the movie occurred when no one knew what actually happened. But there's this big superstorm in the States, which has caused a lot of trouble. And, of course, everyone's saying it's nothing to do with climate change, nothing, let's look away. But it was a hurricane that joined up with a tropical storm that trapped up with a winter storm, and they kind of merged all together, and you have this huge thing. If you get pictures from it from SACE, it's really, really impressive. But New York is being drowned. West Virginia is getting huge blizzards and snowfall. And instead of going back out to sea like most hurricanes do, it's going inland because, again, this winter storm has attracted it. It's quite a mess. I think they'd call it in England a higgly-piggly.
It is a pickle.
Yes.
But anyway, we have lots of interesting news here.
That was interesting news. Okay.
Okay, fine. That's interesting news. We have additional interesting news, a perfect storm of interesting news.
Exactly, exactly. Now, what a lot of people, of course, in the United States would often do, and I would definitely not recommend, is if you wanted to avoid the storm, is you pray for it. You just say, God, please, please, please. And the whole idea of prayer is not the focus of our next little news item, but it's actually the Bible. And apparently in Chilliwack, a parent complained that the school board was essentially allowing the Gideons to give away free Bibles to their students. He said that he thought, well, this wasn't really an appropriate locale to give away Bibles, and he issued a complaint to the school board. The school board, in a private, not-for-public sort of viewing, reviewed his request and said, we don't care. But there's been a lot of sort of talk back about this whole issue of should schools be a place where you give out controversial material like this. And I'm going to call it controversial. In the same way that I might want to say, well, I have the Communist Manifesto and I want to distribute it to children at school. Should I be allowed that? And I suspect most people would say, well, I don't know if that's really appropriate, especially for fifth graders, right? So in the same way, it's like, well, why should these Gideons get special privilege in that? And a lot of the rancor over it has turned to be quite nasty. In fact, the person who initially said the complaint. And when he said it, he says, you know, I don't want to make too much of this, but I don't think it's that appropriate. So could you look into it? There's been a lot of sort of, you know, hey, if you don't like this country, go back to where you come from. He has a very ethnic name. I'm not sure if that's equates to whether he is ethnic or not, but it's like, you know, this was a Christian nation and founded on Christian principles, and if you're a Muslim or Hindu, well, either put up or shut up, and it kind of turned kind of nasty in that regards.
Well, I mean, it gets back to the debate whether or not secularism implies specifically non-religious, or whether it implies sort of like a pluralistic point of view in which if you're going to have religion in schools, it needs to be within a context of like religious studies or comparative religion. So, for example, I wouldn't really have a problem with this if they allowed the Gideons to give out Bibles, but they also allowed Hindus to give out their religious texts, Jews to give out their religious texts, and humanists to give out, you know, a treatise on philosophy or something. If they say no to one of those groups, then it becomes, well, now you're favoritism. You're giving one religion preferential treatment. Now, I mean, I guess the easy way to avoid this problem is to just not give any group preferential treatment, especially when it's not like there is a lack of churches in Chilliwack for these students to receive religious instruction. If they were living in the Arctic, for example, and I'm going to assume that there's no churches in the Arctic, well, there probably is, and they had no option whatsoever to get any religious training, then okay, maybe you can make a case that there could be some use for having Bibles in the classroom. But I mean, in the context that they're doing this in, it's not really in that spirit, I don't think.
Well, no, and again, I mean, I think of all the mountains to plant our flag upon, this is not a big one. I mean, there is a process where the students have to take home a form that says, yes, the parent is okay with them receiving the Bible. So, I mean, it's not like they're pushing it onto them. But one of the things that I find annoying about our education system in general, and this just amplifies it, is that they're giving out these Bibles to these kids. But at the same time, they don't have any, like, logic classes or philosophy classes or anything to provide sort of a context for how should you judge this information. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the reasons why the Gideons want to give it to the kids early is because if you indoctrinate them before they have the opportunity to really know what they're dealing with, you've kind of got their hooks in them for life. And I think that if the school board was going to do this, and I mean, they obviously are doing this, they should provide some mechanism or some class that will provide sort of, you know, the world's religion or a philosophy class into how to judge claims or something like that, and not have this sort of isolated thing.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, on another front, we're going to go to Indiana, which is not a Canadian province yet, but we're hoping.
Well, you never know. I mean, there's an election coming up. You never know what happened.
Get a ballot on the election there. CFI, I believe it is, the American version of it, is gone to court to request the ability to solemnize marriages. So in Indiana and in most parts of the world, there's actually kind of two parts to getting married. One, you go to the government and you get a marriage license. And then that marriage license is kind of notarized or made public by what they call solemnization. It's essentially the public declaration of, hey, we are now considered to be one political unit. In Indiana, and again, this is repeated in most provinces and most states, that is limited to essentially two groups of people, religious figureheads like a priest, a rabbi, or something like that, or a government official, a judge or a city clerk.
Or a military officer.
Okay. Or a military officer.
No, they can do it too.
Ship's captains, maybe, yeah. I guess, if the TV shows. But what they wanted, what CFI was sort of saying, well, you know, this seemed kind of discriminatory that, you know, you could have, okay, government officials maybe, because it is technically a legal document, right? So that might not be so hard. But why do you allow these sort of other non-governmental, if you look at it from an alien point of view, random people to do it, but you disallow other people to do it? And so they're suing for at least the right to solemnize marriages just by becoming sort of a notary or what have you. But really the juxt of their argument, and this is one I support wholeheartedly, is that, you know, the two are kind of a separate thing in the sense that if you get married, you go to the government, you get this legal document that says you are now married, period. And that's marriage. That's we can call it a civil union, whatever you want, but that is all you need to do. After that, if you want to celebrate it, have some sort of ceremony, however you want to do that, sure, that has no legal weight. That is merely a social function, which you're welcome to do. And if you kind of separated the two, you get around a lot of those sort of, you know, issues they have with same-sex marriage and all that sort of thing, because a church would not then be forced to solemnize a marriage because it would have no weight in legal course. And it allows a lot more opening up of society and less of this sort of archaic dependence we have on these outdated institutions like churches to perform essentially still necessary functions like marriage.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's interesting. The CFI group in Indiana does do marriage, well, they officiate weddings, but I believe they do it sort of kind of like a legal loophole sort of way by basically declaring humanism a religion and then sort of officiating it. And then I think the rubber stamp has to come from like a judge or something like that. But I mean, there are sort of ways around that, but it would be nice to actually just sort of have, you know, equal standing within the law to, you know, if someone can go online and get anointed a priest, I don't see why there's such a big deal of having a secular wedding.
Yeah, and again, I think there's some odd aspects, as we were just talking before about equal time, where they actually spell out which religions get to do this. And again, I don't think they've probably ever denied a religion not to do it. But I mean, they even go so far as, German Baptists or something. It was like a very weird specific group, which maybe if you know the history of Indiana, not that weird. Now, of course, in order to know what is weird and what's not weird, is you need to have sort of an idea of what the population is doing. And so we sort of talked before about some of the fallout from the dropping of the mandatory long-form census. And apparently there is another new issue that has arisen that's been uncovered. And this sort of has two parts. I mean, one, the voluntary nature of it, and two, the scientific authenticity of it. So when people were going through the results of the census, one of the things they noticed is that the number of people who spoke English as their mother tongue rose dramatically, and the number of people who said that they had another mother tongue dropped like almost in half. And they said, well, this is a really kind of weird statistical anomaly. So they went back and they kind of tried to figure out where it was, and they discovered, you know, a few interesting things. And largely it's that we don't really know. And because before, the long-form mandatory census, one was mandatory, so you kind of had a better statistical analysis as to who was doing it. We no longer have that. But the other point is that when it came up to the question to say, what is your mother tongue? And there are other issues in this as well. But when it comes to your mother tongue, it was like, so where did you come from? What is your ethnicity? Like, there's a whole series of questions about your ethnicity and where you come from and are you an immigrant and all that. And then it was like sort of, what is your mother tongue? And on this new form, it's like, where do you live? How many people live in your house? What's your mother tongue? How much do you make a year? And it's just, it's right there in the middle. And from a historical point of view, whenever Stats Canada changed the census form, it would do a lot of test questions to try and ensure that when they inserted a new question or if they changed a question, that they could assess what effect that change in and of itself would make, so that when they got the data from it, they could see where it was a result of a change in society versus where it was a change in the census form. But when our illustrious leader, Harper, came in and said, oh, we're going to change it, we're dropping the form next week, you have to put in a what is your mother long into the short form of the question now, and it changed the whole dynamic of how that question was. The scientific validity of that whole data set now is in question. I mean, it's not quite garbage, but as far as the long-term validity of that data, it's essentially broken now and mm-hmm. cannot be really fixed.
Without reevaluating the census itself.
Well, you'd have to restore the mandatory long-form census. And to be fair, at least now Stats Canada has a few years to try and test to see how it will affect the next one so they can account for that change. So not only was it kind of bad that the mandatory form was dropped and there were repercussions for that, but the fact it seemed like such a snap decision didn't even allow Stats Canada enough time to deal with the fact that there was this change coming along. And again, as we get more and more into this, we're seeing how more and more there are repercussions that perhaps just a non-scientifically literate mind would not have thought about. Just, oh, it's just a bunch of questions. What does it really matter? Stats Canada, the work they do, the statistical analysis in the long term, it's serious science. It has a big implications in our life, and it's important to do it right. Mm-hmm. Speaking of doing things right, I know I'm firing fast and furious here. These are things that I thought were important to bring up, but we didn't want to spend a lot of time on them. But one of the things that we may bring up again in the future is that, well, maybe the anti-vaxxers were right. They are recalling the flu vaccine. Oh, no, that must mean there's something wrong with it, Ethan.
Well, surely there must be something wrong with it to recall, otherwise it must be silly.
Yes. Well, in an odd sort of way, it is. There is something wrong with it, but it's not really that silly. But it's not bad either, because when they do a recalls, they do recalls for one of two reasons, especially with regards to vaccinations. They either do it because there's something wrong with the vaccination that will increase your risk or will harm you in some way. But in this particular case, the recall is because it's ineffective or the efficacy of it has been reduced. Now, one of the things they had noticed with the flu vaccine that comes from, Norvadis, is that they saw little clumps in it. So if you looked at it, it would look kind of foggy. There'd be like little bits and chunks in it. And apparently the protein that is the activated agent in it was clumping together. And because of that, I mean, there was no risk to you because you were getting the same amount of vaccine and the proteins itself are all in there. So there's no increased risk. But one of the ways that vaccines work is you want to have as much exposure to these proteins as possible so that your body learns what this particular infectious agent looks like. When the protein clumped together, you reduce the surface area. So effectively, you were getting a smaller dose than you thought you were getting. And because of that, you weren't getting the sufficient dose to elicit the immune response that they had expected. So essentially, you were getting an ineffective vaccine. It was sort of a waste of time to get it. So that's one of the reasons why, that's the only reason why they recalled it. I only bring it up to let people know that you are going to have friends, I guarantee you, who are in the anti-vax movement, who are going to point to this and say, see, even the government knows it's not safe. They're recalling it from shelves today. So just tell them, no, you're wrong.
Well, we will have to do that then. Let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Freethinker, and we'll be back after this.
CITR 101.9 FM. It's what the whales are talking about.
Winnie Cooper presents the Thursday Concert Series at 560. With one of the biggest video walls in North America, 560 is quickly becoming one of the nicest venues Vancouver has to offer. It currently houses four floors, each presenting you with a different musical vibe. In the coming months, the Thursday Concert Series will showcase some of the biggest local and international acts to hit town. The Thursday Concert Series at 560 Club, located at 560 Seymour Street in Vancouver, BC, presented by Winnie Cooper.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So it's almost Halloween tomorrow. It's Halloween. So that means whenever you put on your radio or visit some kind of store, there's a good chance you're going to be hit with the Monster Mash or Thriller or something. But today I thought we could skeptically analyze some of the other scary songs, because honestly, how many times can you hear Thriller on the radio before you start to get really annoyed by it?
A lot?
I would say like three. Oh. It's probably the most times. Okay. Now, of course, we got your Thrillers, we got your Monster Mashes, you got your Ghostbusters and your Time Warp, and, you know, the obvious examples like Highway to Hell and such. But what are some, you know, less obvious choices? Well, here's one that I think our listeners might be familiar with, that we're loading up right now.
I must admit, I was surprised about this.
Really? See, I think this is a very creepy song. See, this is Hotel California. Now, you might ask, why is this song so creepy? Well, if you listen to the lyrics, The song is about a traveler who stays in a potentially haunted hotel, with the line, "This could be heaven or it could be hell," implying that this hotel in particular is very schizophrenic. And you also get the line, "You can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave," which is, I think, a pretty good sign of demonic possession right there.
Well, actually, and I think, you know, "This could be heaven and this could be hell," I think it's also a metaphor that, you know, you have died.
Yeah.
You know, so did you go to heaven or did you go to hell? And, you know, you don't know. And once you've checked out, you're dead.
Mm-hmm.
You're still dead.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. The song has also encouraged a lot of speculation because in the 1980s, some Christian evangelicals were alleging that Hotel California referred to a San Francisco hotel purchased by Anton LaVey and converted into the Church of Satan. Other rumors suggested that the Hotel California was the Camarillo State Mental Hospital, which, as people often know, mental hospitals are often used in horror films to imply terribly evil places.
Well, worse than that, often mental health institutions in the past were horror places. They were hell on earth, like Bedlam and that in the olden days.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there's lots of reasons why I think Hotel California would be a perfectly suitable, terrifying song. Now, we got another one here that I also think is underrated in its, you know, scariness.
I'm pretty subtle.
Yes. The chorus is that you have better things to leave while the dead also hang on your old girl. So you're coming without control. No one's staying, it's got a hole. Hurricane at the very least. Shadow in the words of the Gypsy Queen. Pretty evil.
It is. You know, it's almost like they were intending this to be a Halloween song because all the evil, but they don't really mention the devil, right? I mean,
not really, but I mean,
that's one of the weird things about Halloween. I mean, it's not a Christian holiday really in any sense. I mean, it's an old pagan holiday about, you know, the dead rising from the grave and that sort of thing. And I think in a way, this Gypsy Queen is right in tune with that.
Well, yeah, absolutely. That's the thing. Halloween is not necessarily demonic, as you're saying, right? And that leads us to sort of our next point, because you can have, horror songs that don't necessarily imply evil, like this one here. So those of you who were fans of will know this as Rockwell Somebody's Watching You. And you might say, why is this a Halloween song? Well, it's all about a paranoid young man who is described in the song as an average man with an average life who must be left alone in an average home. However, he is convinced that he's being watched by some sinister force or forces. Is it a ghost? Is it the government?
I'm just an average man.
Young man
with an average life.
Edgar Allan Poe's madness.
Hey, hell, I pay the price.
And the people on the TV see him. And I'm afraid to wash my hair because I might open my eyes and find somebody standing there.
No, it's really kind of a creepy song when you look at it, even, right? It's I think in an odd sort of way, it was panned quite a bit when it was first released.
Well, it is kind of a bad song.
Well, but only if you look at it a pop music sort of way.
Yes.
If you look at it sort of as a piece of artistry, it's actually not that bad.
Oh, right? This can go right alongside The Raven as one of the all-time disturbing things to come out of the human mind.
Yes, actually. And I think disturbing was often mentioned with it when they were panning it.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, you really look at the lyrics, it gets worse. Because, I mean, this guy soon suspects that everyone is in on the conspiracy. You know, are the neighbors watching me? Is the mailman watching me? I don't feel safe anymore. And I think that, you know, that can really speak to a lot of the skeptic aspects that we deal with. This is this idea of conspiracy theories of, you know, like the Illuminati and the Freemasons controlling the world. I think that speaks very well. And I think with a little context that, you know, radio can provide, that could be an incredibly terrifying experience for a listening audience.
Well, you know, and you couple that with the whole idea these days of the surveillance state and all that, right? And at which point, you know, do you separate reality from figment? I mean, we talk and we often criticize conspiracy theories and that sort of thing. But to a certain degree, I mean, conspiracies do exist. I mean, there are things out there that push the envelope with regards to that. And sometimes it's not. And you really are just crazy.
Yeah.
And what a great time of year to go crazy.
Halloween.
Halloween.
Yeah, absolutely. Why don't we go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
Standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Yeah, it's your man DJ Tamil, and when I'm up in Vancouver, I'm chilling and listening to 101.9, the best station, in the whole Canada. What? I said it.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR. So we have one other, I guess, Halloween-themed story to discuss, and that is NASA announcing the discovery of a zombie planet.
A planet that goes around and eats other planets for their brain?
Well, maybe. It actually, I mean, this does kind of sound like the bad premise for a Michael Bay movie, but it's sort of true. NASA has reversed its position on the existence of an exoplanet called Formalhaut B. I'm probably saying that wrong, but I don't care. The exoplanet was discovered in 2008, and it was quite a surprise. The main reason was that this was a big planet. It could be actually seen without the aid of a telescope.
Really?
Yes, which would have meant this planet was about 3 times bigger than Jupiter. And that's a pretty darn big planet. It also had a very large dust cloud orbiting the planet, which was also kind of interesting. Now, there were some problems, though. Despite efforts to look for it, the Spitzer telescope couldn't locate it. And the planet wasn't appearing in infrared scans, which, well, that was kind of really strange, because a planet that size should be appearing on those type of scans.
So I'm a little confused here. So they discovered the planet that they didn't see, but you should be able to see it. So how did they know in the first place that they thought they saw it, even though they didn't actually see it?
Well, they found it with, like, the Hubble telescope, and they could also see it with their as a tiny dot in the sky, obviously. But when they pointed an infrared telescope, the Spitzer, at it, it wasn't appearing. So something was not adding up here. So they sort of wrote it off as a mistake of observation. However, they reevaluated the Hubble telescope images. And I have a quote from Thane Curry, who is a former astronaut with NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, and now a UT researcher. Quote, although our results seriously challenge the original discovery paper, they do so in a way that actually makes the object interpretation much cleaner and leaves intact the core conclusions that Formalhaut B is indeed a massive planet. So Curry and his team took a second look at Hubble's observations from 2004 to 2006, and they were able to locate the planet, and they found that it maintained a consistent brightness, so there the planet was. They also examined the data from the planet's orbit, and they found that the orbit was consistent and that the debris and dust cloud, it was indeed there. So they're like, well, why if it's there, why can't we see it in the infrared? Well, Curry suggests that this is because the planet isn't actually that big, and it's a bit smaller than we thought, which could explain why we can't detect it with infrared, because it's not big enough to have enough heat. But if it's not big, how does it hold the dust cloud? Well, he thinks that the dust cloud itself is made up of a lot of smaller objects like boulders or asteroids themselves that are constantly colliding and creating this dust cloud. So it's very similar to how Saturn got its rings. It's this, the dust cloud itself is kind of holding it together, which also would make it easy to see with the naked eye because you can, the dust cloud is, gives it more light refraction. Now, so the theory is now consistent, so we know that this planet is in fact there. It's not quite as big as we thought. There's just one question. Where does the zombie part come into it? Well, I read the original press release, and what I can tell, it appears to be a dumb Halloween publicity stunt. So, there you go.
Goes right up there with life on Mars discovered on Earth. You know, with the little bacteria guys that they had out there, arsenic-eating bacteria. Sort of jumping ahead for the big splash in the news. Sad, I guess, in a way.
Yeah, I think this is a science communication fail.
Especially when, I mean, they could have gone with Ghost Planet. They could have gone with so many other things that, you know, still would have been horrible from a scientific point of view. But at least you could kind of see how they could shoehorn it in.
Like,
you know,
Jesus planet?
we can see the planet, but it's not really there.
Yes.
You know, even the dust cloud would kind of give you that ethereal sort of look.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, but what can you do? NASA, you know, they're still under budget right now. They really have to appeal to the basest common denominator to get their...
And speaking of the basest common denominator,
yes,
I was really annoyed the other day.
Really? Why is that?
Well, Sam Harris, awful atheist and neurobiologist, philosopher of ethics, yada, 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 was at UBC for a chat. And I thought I'd reserve tickets, but it worked out that I didn't quite. But I was there in time for them to kind of, well, we'll let three people in. We'll let two more people in. We'll let one more person in. And it was between me and this rather nice-looking blonde woman. And guess which one they let in as the very last possible person? The woman. I'm sure it had nothing to do with my great looks, but anyway, sexism live and well in UBC, or at least that's my personal spin on it. Sam Harris was here to talk about free will, and fortunately, to get Sam Harris's view on this, Ethan, who is a bit more organized than I are, actually partook in, or got to actually listen to his lecture there. I listened to a similar lecture streamed online, so we both kind of have an idea what Sam Harris has to say. But the main focus of it was on the idea of free will. So we thought we'd spend a minute or two, or 20, about free will. What is free will? Well, it revolves around sort of two concepts, obviously will and free. Surprise, surprise. Will, at least, before I go on, I should mention one thing because we're probably going to get emails from this. This is sort of my area of study in philosophy, but at the same time, we're dealing with sort of people who are not big philosophy people. So for those who know the philosophy, you may sit back and say, hey, Don, you're misusing that term a little bit or whatever. I'm doing this for the lay people, so don't jump on me too hard. So will. What is will? Essentially, it's what we call our sense of agency. That is sort of a fancy philosophical term that means essentially that I am the agent or the cause of a particular action. The idea of will is perhaps one of the oldest concepts to humanity, and maybe even longer, depending on how you believe in psychology. Where do we get this sort of sense of independence from our body? Of course, in a naive sort of way, we know that there's sort of this voice in the head that is me, unless you have a psychological illness, in which case it might be me, him, and someone else. But historically, we know that that this is sort of you, but it's not really from your body. It's somehow a sense of immaterial self. I hear the voice, but there's no mouth making the voice, so I must be hearing it somehow. If we think about, in another sort of sense of the term, if we think about the times when we've been hit really, really hard, you know, like in a car accident or something, or in the old days, when someone gives you a smack on the helmet with a sword, you feel your body move, and you can kind of feel yourself moving within your body. There seems to be a sense of detachment there. If you sit there and you had, and hopefully this never happens to you, your hand cut off or a spear through your leg or something, and you go into what we now call shock, you know, because you look at it, that you should feel pain, but you don't feel pain. It's like, again, you're somehow detached from your body. And this is where sort of the whole idea that there is a me inside of the body that is me, that there is more than just the physical body. And here we enter into the concept of what they call dualism. When we saw this sort of detached part, we think about, well, who is the we that we're talking about? When I'm rattling around in my brain or I hear the voice, what do we mean that? Well, Christians would often call this, you know, our soul. Other cultures would call it, you know, our life force. Not all of them had super religious things. One of the things, like life force, is often interpreted in some cultures as sort of like the flame above a fire, you know. So it doesn't have to be really spooky or religious, but is definitely sort of separate from this. Now, of course, before my atheist friends sort of laugh at how silly this may sort of sound, if you think about a pre-medical society where you have a friend or family member who's some sort of injury, disease, or even suffers a really severe fever that induces coma or brain death, the body's still there. It's still working. You know, you're breathing, the blood is pumping. To a certain degree, you can kind of eat and digest and poop and do all the things that the physical body's doing, but there's literally no one there. You could be kind of excused at that point to think that the body itself was not all there was to the person. Dualism proposes that this is literally true, that there is an immaterial part of the self that is beyond the physical body. This sort of actually provides a useful concept when later on, as scientific discoveries increased and implied that there's sort of more of a deterministic world, that everything is sort of physical and that we're not free. Dualism gets around this sort of idea, at least initially, by saying, well, you know, there is a part of you that is not physical, but is spiritual, is something else. So this goes into now the second part. So what do we mean by the idea of free? In this context of our discussion, free will means essentially the possibility of choice, that there's not an outside source dictating our actions, that the agent not only we are not only the agent of our actions, but we are sort of the sole cause of those actions. Now, this comes into conflict, as I mentioned, with the idea of determinism, because determinism essentially says that all current actions are dictated by previous conditions, plus the laws of nature, plus a certain degree of random chance. Dualism gets around this, again, by removing the agent or the me of my actions from the physical world into a non-deterministic immaterial world, the pure soul, spirit, platonic perfection. So then enters in the idea of materialism. Essentially, materialism denies this duality on two sort of grounds. First, it points out that there's really no evidence for the soul. I mean, we have the sense of soul. Again, when the body, when you have brain death, there's this sense, but you can't find it in any sort of materialistic way. One of the famous experiments done in history was to attempt to weigh the soul, and there's been lots of sort of pseudoscience done in this, that at the moment of death, some people have claimed that the body literally becomes lighter as the soul leaves the body. Now, in any real controlled experiment about this, there is no evidence there to be found, right? It's always been found that if there is a difference, it's some flaw in the experiment. But there is this sort of inability to find any evidence for the soul in a scientific sort of way. So, and actually, materialists will go so far as to say, well, actually, any sense of self can be accounted for now thanks to the idea of psychology and neuroscience, that there is no need for the soul because materialism can account for its actions. And even if you ignore that part of it, secondly, from a logical point of view, at least with the immaterial soul, and long before science came up with this argument, is that if it's immaterial, how exactly does it interact with your body? Your body's material. Immaterial, by definition, cannot interact with the material. That is one of its properties. Pascal is actually quite famous for sort of accepting, in a weird way, the materialist argument that, yes, you know, the body is material, the soul is immaterial. But he got around the soul question by proposing that the pituitary gland was somehow linked between these two sort of areas of existence, that it somehow linked the material and the immaterial. But of course, again, it was an assertion. It just, like, it does. And you go, well, how does it? And he never actually solved the logical issue behind that. Now, most people sort of accept the idea of the death of dualism. At least philosophy, it's pretty much of a dead idea. There have been some attempts to sort of redefine the terms in such a way as to resurrect dualism, but most of those have sort of failed, or it's like the idea of free will, which has been also one of the terms that have been annoyingly redefined, that if the universe was different, I could have done something different, but that's still in this universe right now, I am still materialistic, I still causal. Now, of course, some Christians obviously still believe in the immaterial soul, just in spite of the evidence. And that said, and where we're going to kind of maybe take the lead off into what Sam Harris was saying, is that even with all that sort of empirical knowledge that we have, I still feel like I'm somehow in control. It still seems like there's a me inside of this husk of a body, at least of some sort.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. I mean, if we took out your brain and put you in a new body, I mean, well, you would die, but you might, for a little while, be like, oh, I have a new body, then you would die.
Okay. Actually, that's a huge issue in philosophy, is would you be the same person?
Well, it seems pretty easy to test.
Well, no, because the dying part usually becomes before the, are you Ethan or not?
Oh, right, ethics, yeah.
Yes. So Sam Harris came and he did his little bit of talk about free will, and essentially he put forward, by and large, the materialist sort of argument that, you know, we are physical entities that react to preconditions. We are governed by laws of physics, neuromechanics, that sort of thing. In those areas that aren't governed by that, because there are areas of like quantum fluctuations and cosmic rays and just random chance, but that's not free either, in the sense that you don't have any control over randomness either. Almost by definition, you don't have control over randomness. So in an odd sort of way, he was going with the idea that because of that, you can't really hold someone responsible, at least in a classical sense of responsibility, for their actions. And by classical responsibility, I don't mean that you say, well, he didn't do X, Y, or Z. It's like, he did X, Y, or Z, but he didn't do it in such a sense that would go against the preconditions that led up to that situation. That, in essence, his entire life was leading up to this one point, and he had no choice to do what he did. He did it, and he did it as by his own, quote, free will, but there was no freedom really in that act of action.
Basically suggesting that, simplifying it, the universe is cause and effect. And, you know, if you start the dominoes tipping, that last domino, no matter what it wants to do, is going to get tipped over, right? That's yep. That's essentially what he's saying.
And is that what you got from, I mean, you were there.
Yeah. I mean, to me, his argument more or less was that on the one front, biologically speaking, we're not in control of our own actions, even though we think we are. And he cited a few studies about, you know, the brain registering, you know, neurological signs of action before somebody, say, moves their arm, even though they're saying at the exact same time, I want to move my right arm,
yep.
You know, that kind of thing. And he also cites this was, you know, the cause and effect principle, that regardless of whether or not I want to go to the store, it will not happen because the universe has decreed that an asteroid is going to hit me in the head that day. Okay, sure, I accept that. I honestly didn't find his argument terribly convincing, which is not to say that I disagree with him. I think I sort of agree with him, but I don't really... His way of explaining it to me didn't make me any more convinced.
I think one of the things, and you're kind of implying it to a certain degree, because you didn't like the being able to sort of read one's mind before one has made a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes into the idea that the human mind in and of itself is an incredibly complex thing. And take note, I'm going to use mind and brain somewhat interchangeably here, but there will be subtle differences. So there are aspects of your brain that operate independent of your consciousness, your awareness of what you're doing. So in a sense of the brain itself, of your mind in the bigger sense, it's still part of you, but it's a part of you that you are not necessarily aware of. So I was having a discussion with a friend of mine about something called muscle memory, which, unlike what the name implies, has nothing to do with your memory in your muscles. This is just, there's a part of your brain that will learn particular actions sort of by rote, right? So a tennis player or whatever who goes out, or no, karate, it's better. You know, you see someone who does kung fu or whatever. And one of the reasons why they repeat the movements over and over and over again, so that they can do those movements without actually having to consciously be aware that they are doing them. So there's a part of your brain that is making your muscles do whatever it is they're doing, even though your will, in this particular case, isn't actually there. It's still a part of your mind. It's still you doing it, but you are not actively aware that you are doing it.
Yeah. Well, in that case, Harris mentioned things like, you know, blinking and your heart beating. Like, it's being...
Well, see, I would make a delineation between those two. He's right in the one sense.
Yeah.
But those ones, I mean, you have zero control over, really. I mean, biofeedback,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, muscle memory, I'm moving my arms. It's not like an autonomic response, which is mm-hmm. what heart breathing and blinking is autonomic.
Right.
Right. Even if you are brain dead, you will still do those. If you're brain dead, you're not going to be doing kung fu. Right?
Probably.
So there's a slight difference between those two. But that leads to the point that, you know, just to sit back and say, well, you know, I'm going to the store, and I think I'm going to the store. In the one sense, and this is where I think, Ethan, you feel uncomfortable, even though you agree, in sort of like Hume's induction problem, you know, like, does the sun rise tomorrow? Yes, it's going to rise tomorrow. We have the laws of physics that prove it. Well, all those laws are not really true. We make sort of an assumption in the beginning that what happened in the past will happen in the future, but there's no necessity in that, mm-hmm. right? So we have to kind of take it on faith. In the same sense that we may know that every event that led up to this particular point, this conversation I'm having with Ethan, has been in a sense predetermined. So although there's not a predictability because of probabilistic chance, but everything has led up to this point and I don't really have a lot of control over it, but I still feel like I have control and I am sort of forced to live in the moment, even though I may know intellectually that I don't have a lot of control over what's going on or no control. I still feel as if I do, and I still am forced to act like I have control because, oddly enough, I have no control.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing, too. Like, at a certain point, like, whether or not you agree with Harris's premise or not, I'm kind of left with the conclusion that it doesn't matter. Because if I say I agree with him, nothing, I can't change anything. I can't suddenly, you know, drive my car on the sidewalk, right? And if I disagree with him, I'm like, well, then I'm not going to change anything either. To me, it's sort of like saying, well, every 5 seconds, the universe doubles in size. Sure, okay.
Well, yeah, just to put one more point in it, and just to make sure that Ethan really is on board in here, there's one question or I raised to a friend of mine, we were talking about this before, is that ultimately, even if you're a dualist, or if you believe you're a brain into that, or even if you're a hardcore materialist, there is the lack of the third option.
Mm.
So we know that there are laws and rules that can govern us, right? And there is random chance. But there is no third thing. So if you sit there and say, well, okay, I have a soul, and my soul is going to decide I want chocolate chip cookies, right? Well, why do you like chocolate chip cookies? Well, there's a whole bunch of things that happened in your past, and this is in your immaterial now.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a set of rules that your immaterial mind would work with. Because, I mean, it's still, you know, why do I, well, I've had chocolate chips in the past and all that, right? So there's a set of rules that I think by. And then, of course, I might just, well, just for change, I'm going to have something different. So this is randomness. And there is no third thing to account for free will. If you sit there and you think of free will as in I have the opportunity to do something that I don't want to do, well, what does that mean? That either means you follow the set of rules in your head that led you to conclusion A, or you randomly chose conclusion B. There's no third option there. I mean, there is no third option. And that's why even if you're a dualist or a materialist, I still can't see how you could accept the idea of free will as we like to think it, because even logically it breaks down.
Mm.
Now, to answer Ethan's more practical question, and I think where Sam Harris was going with this, and this is, I think, a natural offshoot of the moral landscape, is the idea, okay, so we still have to live in a world where people seem to have choice, but we kind of know on one level they don't. And then he goes into the idea, well, the criminal court system, right? Actually, to preface that, he actually goes into religion, because this is Sam Harris. You can't have a discussion without kicking a religion at least once. So he sort of says, well, one of the areas where the idea of free will is important comes into it is that if you willingly did something, if I willingly killed a person, then you are morally responsible. If you are morally responsible, I have the right of retribution. I can punish you simply because you did that act willingly. And that's, again, one of the, you know, Old Testament sort of things with it.
Yeah. I mean, that, like, yeah, exactly. That you, that's a contestable point, though, the retribution.
Well, and this, like I say,
a moral right, you know, is what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth.
Yeah.
If you're a hardcore religious person, you got to believe that God said it. So, but yeah. So, again, where he was going for, and again, this applies to the secularists as well as skeptics and religious people and all that, is you hear about a Clifford Olson or something like that who murdered 15 people, right? Mm-hmm. On the one hand, you can sit there and say, well, he didn't have a choice in it, so he's not at fault and we should let him go. Well, in a practical matter, that's stupid, right? But on the other hand, there's this traditional sort of the three R's of incarceration. Retribution, restitution, and rehabilitation. Essentially, Sam Harris is saying if we take a serious look at how the idea of free will works, we eliminate the idea of retribution. So we still need to essentially protect society from these people. Because even if they have no choice in what they do, they still have no choice what they do, which means they might do it again, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you have to protect society. So he's not saying you don't do anything with them. But you don't punish them because of what they did. You protect society from what they did, which means you might have to put them in prison forever. And then you treat them as if they are, like you say, a product or an ill individual. So you rehabilitate them as best you can. And yeah. To be fair, you know, because people are at the pinnacle of whatever events led up to them, if someone is loses their head, right? I mean, literally loses their head, there's only so much rehabilitation you can do. So some of these people are going to be lost causes. But you eliminate sort of the vindictiveness that you quite often see in a judicial system. The idea that, you know, not only did you do this crime, but I want to make you suffer because you did this crime. And he's kind of saying, well, that is in itself almost an immoral act because the person, in a very sort of real sense of the word, didn't have a choice in doing the moral act. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean you don't put them away, you don't protect society. It doesn't mean you don't try and rehabilitate them, which in some cases means solitary confinement because there's only so much you can do with them. But there isn't this sort of Old Testament meanness, wrath to it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can actually agree with that, but not for the reasons that Sam Harris outlines. But more agree for the reasons that, like, say, Steven Pinker outlines, that it's not an effective form of, like, fixing problems in society. One way that I sort of look at it is that our method of correcting bad behavior, whether it's prison or beheading somebody, it all comes down to the fact that it's an imperfect solution to an imperfect problem. Like, we can't, maybe someday in the far distant future we'll have a pill that treats evil. Like, and of course that raises this whole new set of problems, like you're taking away people's free will to be evil. But
you don't, because they don't have it in the first place. Ethan, haven't you been listening to me?
But the point is, like, I think one of the problems that I see with Harris's argument, when he suggests things like, you know, if we're treating evil like a disease, and he made the argument, I forget the person's name, but he killed his family, then he went on top of a clock tower and shot a bunch of people. Famous case. Turned out he had a brain tumor that was pressing against a certain part of his brain, making him unpredictable. I think that, you know, if we looked into the brains of various killers and we saw, oh, they have increased levels of X or Y or this, there's a chemical imbalance, we're not at a stage chemically or neurologically to understand what those variables even mean. Like, I think Steve Novella mentioned that you can put a dead fish in an MRI and see things light up. That doesn't necessarily mean what we think it means, because a part of the brain is lighting up doesn't mean that brain is active. I think that we're too young in our understanding of brain chemistry to make the logical leaps that Harris is making. Even though I can see where he's going with it, and I can see there's maybe a certain probability that he's right, I'm not quite willing to jump onto that bandwagon just yet.
Well, I'm gonna parse that with two questions. I mean, in the one sense, actually, I don't think he's making a logical argument. I think he's making a practical argument for it. Mm. He's sort of saying, well, you know, or maybe you're, maybe I'm going to flip that. Maybe you're making a practical distinction. So he's saying that philosophically they can't be blamed. And you're saying, well, I might agree with that. But at the moment, we don't have the science to detect what possible illnesses are the result of that, which, again, I think it's taking a bit more than what he has. But you said you probably kind of don't. So where in there don't you? So do you think people should suffer for a crime they committed?
Well, I look at it from more of a societal image. Like, that's, like, I'm a historian. So I look at things, try to look at things in a big picture. Let's say you have a person who commits a violent crime, right? And this person, you have two options. You can sort of, you know, kill him or incarcerate him. Suppose if you kill him, that's a violence against him, obviously. But if you incarcerate him and don't kill him, you're going to have riots in the street, massive civil upheaval, because maybe this person is a member of a despised minority group or majority group or whatever, a war criminal, who knows, right? I don't necessarily look at things from the point of view of the our decision must be made based on an individual case, but rather a societal case. So, I mean, I'm looking at things like, you know, yes, you can, there may be a justifiable reason for why you execute a war criminal, because if you don't, you're going to have a huge problem for the next 20 years, you know, dealing with anger issues and civil disobedience or international relations that just go toxic. You know, like, you look at, say, for example, how they dealt with Nazi war criminals. They killed most of them. Eichmann, I think, is the only citizen to be executed in Israel.
I think historically, actually, most Nazi war criminals actually they had prison terms. The big guys were almost all executed.
Yeah.
But actually, see, again, I think you're in a lot of ways sort of supporting the Sam Harris argument in a weird way. Is you sort of said, well, you know, there are these groups that you know, that they may represent, like the Nazis or whatever, right? So I wouldn't limit Sam Harris's analysis to just an individual who's sick, but because if this person is... And again, I know I'm stretching the term illness here. I'm not sure what else word to use. Mm. But if he's a product of the society and the culture, we can now look back and say, okay, it's not that he's necessarily a bad egg. He doesn't necessarily have a brain tumor. Maybe his family wasn't that bad. So what else in our society caused him to do what he did, right? And in which case, that makes it more... prescriptive than descriptive. And you're also pointing out that if more people buy into this idea that, you know, we don't have the free will as we sort of think about it, but people are the product of their endpoint, there won't be the rashness to punish the person directly, although there still will be the rashness to say, well, protect us from him and prevent him from ever coming again. Mm-hmm. And that's what you want to do. You want to prevent a repeat of whatever caused this person to be like this in the first place. If you just blame him and say he was free to do this, you're essentially letting society off the hook for whatever other circumstances, be it genetics, bad parenting, Nazis, that created him in the first place.
Yeah. I think we're going to have to wrap up right now here on Radio Free Thinker, so we'll have to leave this question hanging. If you have any ideas on it, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com. Let's go to our skeptical highlights very quickly. Vancouver Skeptic Camp is coming up on November 3rd. It starts at 9:30 in the morning, goes to 5 p.m. All-day skeptical conference. It's free. Register online at vancouver.skepticcamp.org. Breakfast and lunch are provided if you register. And it's at UBC Buchanan Building, Room A201. So hopefully we'll see you there.
And Friday and Saturday, there is a Media Democracy Day. So they're going to have panels and discussions about decolonizing media, who's watching you, the politics of surveillance, big data and political marketing, and muzzling the scientists. Again, links will be on our website. Oh, and Ethan, just in case if I'm not here next week, there's an election in the United States. And it's going to be so much fun.
Yeah, so much fun. See you next week, folks.
Eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.